This is the continuation of session 5.
Yeah.
I'm a nurse in cancer research. We give a lot of trial drugs. Knowing that a lot of animals are given these experimental drugs and harmed and then eventually killed, do I collect some of the karma of that even though I'm not involved with the animals, but then it comes directly to me giving it to patients?
She said she's involved in cancer research, and sometimes their company might give experimental drugs to animals knowing that it will kill them to see how their effects are. Two answers to that. First is the Abhidharma Kosha, fourth chapter, has a very similar question. And the question in the Abhidharma Kosha is, in the case of a war, it's really the person on the front lines who's pulling the trigger and killing the other person. So do all the other people in the army collect that karma equally, or do they just collect some of the karma? And what about the people back home who are sending money for the war effort and stuff like that? And the answer in the Abhidharma is everyone who is involved knowingly and happily and who's supporting it wholeheartedly collects exactly the same karma as the guy who pulls the trigger. You know, which is a good argument for a sort of activism, I think, you know, that working to stop a war effort or something like that, because we are collecting that karma. Now, it depends on how wholehearted your support of it is. Very much depends on your wholehearted support. If you're not wholeheartedly supporting it, and in fact, you're mentally disassociating it from it, you know, like, I don't agree with the arms race. I don't think the United States government should build nuclear weapons. But my work is more important than going to jail right now. By not paying my taxes. So I do pay my taxes, I inform my representatives that I object and I disassociate myself from that, and then you don't collect much karma, okay? Second thing is, under extraordinary circumstances, you can think of that, if you conceptualize it as being of great benefit to other beings, that you're seeking to help thousands or millions of beings, if you really conceptualize it that way, then it can be a very good karma. Okay, and so it's important for you personally to think of it, if you can't stop it, you know, if you're not in a position to stop it, then that it's important that you conceptualize it as being of great benefit to other people, like that, okay, to many people. Yeah.
We know it's wrong to drop bombs on kids, you know, to use the Kosovo example. To extend it further and dare get into relativity, I suspect, what do you do when... the person who you're trying to dislodge supposedly is a very evil type of person,
yeah,
who, if given his way, will exterminate a complete group of people. Now, is it their common to be exterminated? Do we not help them? Do we find another way of helping them, by which time it will be useless? So what attitude does one take?
He's saying the question of, suppose there's a very evil, like a Hitler type of person, who's moving into Kosovo. They're going to be killing all these people. You know they're going to be killing all those people. You have a choice of hurting some of them to stop the... There's a couple of answers to that, okay? First of all, it's their karma to be hurt, so should we not do anything? That's a fallacy. That's not correct, okay? You must take action, okay? First. Secondly, there is the famous example of Lord Buddha in a former life as a ship captain being on a ship, knowing that one of the passengers was going to murder the other passengers, and actually doing a what we call liberation of that person's life in order to save that person from the hell realms. You see what I mean? Not so much to save the other 499 people. You get it? To save that person from a bad karma. Then there's the statement in Pabongka Rinpoche or someone in such questions, imagine the evil people as if it were that you came home one day and your mother had gone crazy and you're in the kitchen with her and she grabs a steak knife and goes after you. Now, would you just kill her? We're talking your own mother. Or would you try to... would you probably come up with a different method of restraining her very quickly? You know what I mean? And if it was someone that you really totally loved, you would... If you love them as much as you loved your own mother, then you would very likely come up with a what we call in Tibetan logic a pungsumba, a third possibility, you know, between killing them or just being murdered, you know. That's my other answer. Fourth answer, ultimately, killing cannot lead to saving life. If you take an action and they are saved, it's not because you killed someone. And that you have to cook. That you have to think about. Okay, if killing, if making war were the cause of peace, then it should always work. Then every time we take up arms, there should be peaceful settlement within 6 months or 6 weeks or 6 days. Okay, if taking up arms and hurting other people is not the cause of peace, then it should be unpredictable. Then sometimes war should end in peace, and sometimes war should end in continued war, and that's how it works. So ultimately in Buddhism we say that harming other people can never lead to peace because of the dissimilarity of the cause and the result. And that's what Jesus meant when he talked about, you know, planting lemon seeds and getting orange trees. It doesn't happen. That the idea that harming could lead to happiness is impossible. According to the laws of karma, this is impossible. Okay? You're harming someone will lead to harm to yourself in the future. And if it works or not is totally dependent on those people's past karma, not on what you're doing. Okay, that's a very deep answer and very difficult. But you have to think about it. The bottom line, fifth answer, whatever you do, if it's done with total compassion and total regard for the well-being of both the evil person and the person they're hurting, then you're on very safe ground. Okay, no matter what you do, whether you act or don't act, the important thing is to love both parties. Then you've done the right thing. Get it? That's true in all situations. The test is not whether you do A or B. And don't let your mind convince you that that's the problem here. The big test is whether or not you're acting out of a true love for both parties. Okay? And that's the hardest thing of all. Okay? Yeah.
I think you use a lot of drugs at the time of death. Does that somehow affect the transmission? I mean, if somebody's in terminal pain, received mega doses of narcotics, an intoxicant, I mean, how does that affect them?
Intoxicants are bad because they lower your inhibitions. You see, I mean, that's the Buddhist position on intoxicants. They are wrong insofar as a person who's had a few drinks is more likely to hurt someone or say something negative than a person who hasn't had those drinks. At the last moments of life, if you're trying to, you know, prevent gross pain in a person and give them, what they call it, something, Brompton's solution? Or
Brompton's
cocktail, which my father was on for a while. Then I don't imagine it could be wrong from the point of view of using intoxicants. And I don't think it's presented that way. But I think because they're not going to be inhibited or less inhibited, they're going to be unconscious mostly. But as far as affecting the clarity of their thought, I'd say give them as little as you can to keep them out of pain. But it's still important to die with a clear mind. My lama has often complained that the medications he has to... He's almost 80. He's taking many different kinds of medication. And he says he can consciously feel their effect on his intellect and the clarity of his mind, and he's very hesitant to take some of them. And he's like cheating sometimes. He'll take half a pill instead of a whole pill. And if his blood pressure is okay, then Vasotec, you know, he'll refuse to take the extra half because he says it affects the clarity of his mind, you know. So, that's okay.
For dilemmas like Kosovo, what mantra would you suggest we do for like all parties and...
Yeah, we'll go on to some month. Okay, ready? Here we go. By the way, while we were on the question of euthanasia, we threw in some abortion question to get Rinpoche to make a comment on it. You know, and obviously abortion is wrong because there is life at the time that the mind enters the womb. At the time that there's conception, there's life. And Rinpoche went on to say, it was interesting because he said, I consider abortion the most repugnant kind of murder. And we said, why? And he said, this guy doesn't have any chance to fight back. You know, it's one thing to kill a soldier in a war who's also got a gun. And it's another thing to mug a healthy adult who can punch you back. But this guy can't move, can't do anything, and you're just killing him. You know, and he said, that makes it really unfair. Okay. What's the Buddhist position on contraception? We went on to that because we wanted to get clarification on it. If it's a kind of contraception that prevents the meeting of the egg and the sperm, it's cool. No problem. There is no conception, and there is no coming in of the mind. If it's like a morning, as I understand, there's a morning after pill and something else called an IUD, which actually breaks up the cells after conception. That's murder. Okay, so that's a distinction that you have to to know. Is it okay to use contraception that prevents conception? Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Although Rinpoche once said, "Yeah, but you're kind of depriving somebody of a holy human life," you know. You know, he once said that. Now I don't know how serious he was. Then, you know.
With the morning after pill, like yeah. It's literally the morning after, so there's no way to know whether the AIM's firm met. Is that still wrong?
I'd say if there's a chance that. She said about a morning after pill, if you're not sure that Ignis Burnham met, I'd say, what? Then you're saying, if there's a 50% chance I murdered somebody or not by taking this action, should I do it or not? I mean, I'd say, don't do it, you know. I just say as a system, don't use it, you know what I mean? Is there any way that we can help a person after they die? And they say that Rinpoche is talking about the force of prayers and that you can help them. And the principle here is we do a thing called a jang chok. And it's the one that we do is based on Yamantaka practice. You ask trained people who are properly trained, to do a service or a special ritual where normally you take some clothing of the dead person or something that they were very attached to. And you place it on a chair, and then you try to attract their mind from the Barno to that place. And they have special powers in the Barno. They can hear things that we can't hear. They can travel quickly. In fact, the function of the Barno and the reason there is a Barno is to move to the location of your next birth. That's the only reason there is a Barno. If you're being born into the formless realm, there is no Barno. Because you take birth in the formless realm wherever you happen to die. So there's no need for a Bardo. The function of a Bardo is to get to the next place that you're going to be born. And it can move with the speed of like light. So they have special powers. They can hear you. Under special karmic circumstances, which are totally determined by their own karma, they can hear you, they can see you, they can hear the prayers. And so then we do special prayers to try to to encourage them to lead a life of the six perfections in the future and to try to regret the deeds they've done. We burn some special seeds, and they represent this person's bad deeds. We burn a little piece of paper with their name on it and special things. And you're asking them all the time in Tibetan to think that now your bad deeds are being burned off and go happily, and it helps them. They can hear it. Then we objected to Rinpoche. We said, well, how many Americans understand Yamanta rituals done in Tibetan? You know? And he said, they have the power to understand other languages at that time. They understand the meaning of your words, even though you're saying some kind of words. And this gets into the power of mantra. So the mantra can help them. And as they're dying, say mantras. Rinpoche said, Om Mani Padme Hum, in their ear softly, even if they were not Buddhist. As long as the family wouldn't object, okay? As long as there's not going to be a scene because you're doing that. If everyone's cool with it, gently recite mantras around them, even hours after they've died, and do it like that, okay? And keep reciting them. They can be around for a total of 49 days. And we asked Rinpoche, why 49 days? Why not 48? Why not 50, you know? And it's an interesting answer. He said, Bardo beings only live for 7 days at maximum. They must die within 7 days. And you can only take 7 consecutive Bardo lives in a row. So the max time that you're in the Bardo is 49 days. And it's important to do a ritual on the 7th day because by then they will have changed lives once. So that's the idea behind doing a ritual on the 7th day and the 49th day. Then we asked him, how do you count it? Do you count it from the next day? Or he said, count it from the day of death. So the day of death is day one. And then you count 49 days out. 7 days out and 49 days out. I would say you try to get them to do Chang Chok as quickly as possible. The Yamantaka prayer, whichever one you're going to use to try to attract their mind and help them. Do that as soon as possible. And personally, what we do in New York is we have a bunch of monks in at Sera who know how to do it. And we send, we call them or send an email. Now we have email and they start right away. And then I have an account there, and they take it out of the account, and then I try to get the money back. You know? So that's how we work it. You know?
Is it more powerful if you are physically closer to the person, like say the folks are doing it in India, as opposed to you being right there? Is it more powerful if you're there?
Any last is more powerful if you're close by to the dead person. I think it's much more powerful if you're nearby. I think probably the odds that they would hear you and everything are better. But again, Bardo beings have amazing power. to move, and they can move great distances very easily. But I think if you do it in the vicinity of their home, they often stay in the vicinity. The mind stays in the vicinity of the home and the body for a while, because there's this familiarity with it, and they're oftentimes attached to that place. And I think it'd be nice if you could do it near to where the death took place. It'd be nice to train some Americans to do it, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
do they still have wind? Yeah, they still have wind, yeah.
Is it right to do something like Chan Chu for someone who's not a Tibetan Buddhist?
Chang Chok, yeah.
Chang
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Chok means ritual and Chang means purification. Chang Chok, okay. Yeah.
Is there any particular mantra that you would say for a family member who is angered by the death of a loved one?
Who is what?
Who's angered by the death of a loved one.
Angered in what way? Or just upset, you mean? Or?
Well, like one of my friends, her dad died of cancer.
Yeah.
And she used to be Buddhist, and now she's not anymore because she's so angry that her dad died.
Just angry about the fact that he died.
That he died and left her
yeah.
alone.
Oh, angry at him? Or?
Angry that he died.
Oh, okay. No, I think then the best thing is, I mean, Buddhism stresses very much logic and explaining to somebody why that's crazy, you know what I mean? And then apparently she didn't understand much at all about karma or anything like that. He didn't want to die, I'm sure. And you know what I mean? And to be angry at him for dying or to be angry about his death, that's the same thing as being angry at another person for saying something bad to you or something. We call there are two kinds of anger. One is towards people, one is towards inanimate objects like traffic jams or elevators that don't work right. And they're absolutely the same level of karma. You see, I mean, to be angry at a stone that you've stubbed your toe on and to be angry at another person who said something to you is exactly the same karma. It doesn't matter whether it's a person or an inanimate object. So I would just try to explain that to them and say, you know, that's just a bad karma to be angry. And then you have to teach them about karma, you know, that the reason they had to see their father die is that they contributed towards someone else's death. You see what I mean? And it's really... it's her own deeds coming back to her. And by being angry, she's assuring that it'll be worse. You see what I mean? So try to get her to take refuge, which means to try to protect her own self by not being angry. Because as long as you're angry, you build up very bad karma. So, and then you might try tap tul, tap ke, skillful means. Take her out for a bunch of nice dinners. Take her to some nice movies, you know. Take her to a very, or let her listen to a very light tape about, you know, sneak her back into Buddhism the back way. You know, oftentimes the frontal approach is not the way. You know, just make her comfortable about being a Buddhist and talk to her slowly and don't expect too much and do it gradually. And I think that's a good way to bring a person back. You know, yeah.
Isn't that the type of anger that he's talking about? An anger of suffering, it's a form of suffering.
Yeah.
Even though Ross says that is a part of the grieving process, and it should be allowed to run its course. You can help, of course, but it is a part of the grieving process.
He said, isn't that anger a part of the grieving process? The Abhidharma, you know, I was kind of frustrated that Buddhist texts don't talk more about mental illness. And the Abhidharma does have a short section about mental illness. And it says that grieving is one of the main causes of temporary mental illness. Like, you just go a little bit crazy for a while. And that grief is one of the ways, typical way of causing that kind of mental illness. And then it says... you should still, and you don't collect much bad karma when you're mentally ill. Like if a monk breaks their vows during a short episode of severe mental illness, we don't lose our vows. You see, you're not really smashed the vow. It's not really a complete breaking of the vow. And that's a Vinaya principle. So I'd say you have sort of like karmic, what do you call it? Karma, the rules of karma are suspended during times of extreme mental illness. But still, if you could stop the anger as soon as possible, it would be less bad karma. You see, I mean, it doesn't. Although it's a natural part of grieving, it should still be stopped as soon as you can because it is some negative karma.
And I think it's totally negative or futile to just say stop the anger.
Oh yeah, I've tried it with my students, you know, who and myself having a severe mental affliction, and just they say, "What should I do?" I say, "Stop it," you know. And they're like, "Yeah, I'm talking tough K, skillful means, take them out on a camping trip." You know, I mean, helping someone who's in grief is one of your bodhisattva vows. It's a special bodhisattva vow that when someone's grieving, you have to help them out. And in the medical tantras, it's like take them camping. Let them look at the sky. Let them smell fresh air. Sit them down near a quiet stream. You know, take them to a cafe and have coffee and talk, just light talk. Take them to a movie. These are all, I mean, those, the ancient Indian versions of all those are in the medical tantras as a treatment for someone grieving. So that's the time not to do heavy meditation and talk about Madhyamika philosophy, and it's you know, that's the time to light, to, as a method, is to lighten up and help them and be light with them and get them to relax a little bit. Yeah.
I can understand how the people who choose to have an abortion, that's bad karma for them, but isn't it equally, or, I mean, not to put a value judgment, but isn't it also bad karma to not allow someone to make their own choice, to, you know, force them to do something? Like, an example would be, you know, if you have a family who wants to wash the dead body, you're not going to say, "No, I'm not going to let you do this. You have to let it. You have to let it stay here. There's no choice about it."
Yeah, yeah. This is, I think, she said, "Well, if a person wants to commit an abortion, then really, aren't you doing them violence in the sense of not allowing them to choose by saying they cannot?" You see, I mean, shouldn't you have laws that say they can, but they have to collect all the karma themselves, or something like that, you know? What is your responsibility to try to stop them? Again, I think suicide is similar. You see what I mean? Like, committing suicide in Buddhism is considered a very serious form of murder, because you are eliminating the winds and channels and drops that could have gotten you into a tantric body in this lifetime. And you are wiping out that chance by shooting this body. And so, in a sense, you've committed the worst kind of murder possible. Suicide is the worst kind of murder you can do as a Buddhist. Now, what is our responsibility to allow people to commit suicide if they want to, who don't understand that? Again, I think it gets into the realm of tapkepa, you know, like finding ways to be skillful without making things worse. You know, if it's obvious they're going to do it, and on top of that, they'd be very angry at you, and you would lose your relationship, and blah, blah, blah. Again, it's the steak knife in your mother thing. I mean, I've had students who actually offered to take the baby, you know, and stuff like that. So you might consider something like that, you know. But what's our responsibility to see that legislation is passed to stop people from doing it? I don't know. I can't say that. What is our responsibility to make sure that people don't commit suicide? It's the same thing. It's very similar. I don't know. I think a Buddhist approach would be to try to educate people so that they wouldn't want to do it, and not so much to force them one way or the other. Okay, but like that, yeah.
What about if a person that commits suicide and they're mentally ill, they're like a manic depressive or bipolar?
Yeah, if a person's having a mental episode, you know, and they commit suicide, the karma is much less. Mm-hmm. You see, because collecting a leki lam, which is a pure 100% little egg karma seed, depends on clarity of thought. Clarity of intention. You have to be very clear that this is a living being, that this shouldn't be killed, and for everything you're not clear about, if you're not clear about who you are at that moment or what's going on, the karma is much less. Okay. One thing about funeral ceremony. What kind of mantras? If you know Om Mani Padme Hum, I mean, everybody can do Om Mani Padme Hum. If you know Vajrayogini mantra, in my lineage, in my particular close lineage, we consider that very powerful, and that would be if you've had that teaching in my immediate lineage, Pamoka Rinpoche, Chichen Rinpoche, Ken Rinpoche, we would consider that very powerful to do if you know how to do it. Okay, and Kangye, if you know it, the eight line prayer. Rinpoche, we asked Rinpoche, is it better to burn the body or bury the body? He said it doesn't make much difference at all. In Tibet, they considered if the person was very ill due to epidemic cause, you know, reasons, that it should be treated, you know, the body should be treated in such a way that whatever disease they have doesn't hurt more people. But otherwise, he said, it doesn't matter much. In Tibet, they give the body away to animals to get some last mileage out of the karma, you know. So, Okay. What should be done with the belongings of the dead person? And Rinpoche said very simply, just do exactly what they wished. You know, try to do exactly what their intentions were. And if they didn't leave any clear intentions, then try to imagine what their intentions were. Okay? That's the main thing. Okay, I think we'll stop there. And we'll do a little prayer. Okay.
Sanghe shindu mide umagi Adogu nanakshinma chabasho Idam guru ranamadagam yatayami Gewanti kyogu Sananyeshe tzodokshi Sananyeshe nechume
Last thing I forgot to say about that is get ready for your own death, okay? If you don't practice that well and everything comes down faster than you expected, have people near you who know what to do. I never, ever leave the side of the people that I've trained to treat me when I die. I'm always within 10 feet of them, 15 feet of them, night and day. You know, I've trained people to do what I need, and we have a mutual pact, and that's the way I do it. That's the way I take care of it, personally, and I think it's very wise. You kind of, in your mind, your death meditation's not so strong yet, and you're kind of like, oh, I have time, or it's not something I have to do today, I could wait till tomorrow, or just do it now, you know. Make this deal with people around you. Make sure that the people that you are very close to know what to do. And you know, I used to keep Rinpoche's name and number in my wallet, and then I was thinking, what if they don't look at my wallet, you know? And I think if you can, very preferable to teach someone who's very close to you and that you're close to all the time what to do. Because if you think about it, this is one of the most important things you can do in your life. You know, more important than your job, for example. And it's something you should take care of now. Okay? So in the next few minutes. You know, think about it. Think about getting ready that way. And that someone very close to you is trained and that you're always close to them. Okay? Something like that. All right. See you.
This is the end of session 5. Session 6.
Okay. Ready?
Rira Brinchi Ninde Gyabadi Sangye Shindu Mide Vagi Loku Nandakshina Chapasho Idam Guru Radhamadala Kandiya Dayani Chadam Sagi Chonamma Chanchu Badu Dangi Gatsuji Dagi Chashenge Besanamgi Lola Penche Sange Dubasho Sange Chudan Sogi Chonama Chanchu Badu Dangi Gatsuji Dagi Chashenge Besanamgi Lola Penche Sange Dubasho Sange Chudan Sogi Chonama Chanchu Badu Dani Gapsuchi Dagi Chashenki Besanamki Lola Penche Sange Dubasho.
Okay, cool. So remember you had this staff in your hand and you held it up and you said, one practice, you know. Only practice. You see what I mean? Given the fact that only Dharma can help me, I will concentrate on practicing Buddhism. And then you pointed over to this blue door, right? So you're under the sun, shaft of sunlight, and you're pointing to the blue door with the kadamga, the staff, holy staff, you know. And we're going to go through that practice. The blue door represents... say Dakshin Nyamje. And I'm not going to write it, we don't have much time. So Dakshin Nyamje means Literally, it means exchanging yourself and others. And there's a couple of levels of it, okay? There's a couple of different levels of it. One is to, when you hear the word exchange yourself and others, you think something like putting yourself in the other person's shoes. And that's a very basic level of this meditation, of this practice. You see, so far we've been talking about divesting of things and people and relationships and activities. But what are you supposed to replace it with? You see what I mean? Does it mean that a good Buddhist is the one who's sitting the most and reciting the most things or something like that, you see? Because it sounds like that so far, right? It sounds like I'm telling you to give up 10 hours of your job per week and go home and recite long things 10 hours a day or something like that. It's partly, part of that is that. Part of it is more time at home practicing. But more importantly, the practice, the holiest practice you can imagine, if you're going to die tonight, is Dakshin Nyamje. You see what I mean? And that you can do at work. You see what I mean? That's exchanging yourself and others. In fact, it's even harder when you don't have anybody around. Okay? Like, it's good to be somewhere where there's some people. They say, there's a famous lojong, Yishin Nobu Leilhabe Dunjo Dube Sampai Dr. Chepin Dharni Senchen Tamje La means you need other people around to do this practice. If you didn't have other people around, you couldn't do this practice, you see? So they're more valuable for you than in Aladdin's lamp. On that basis, you can't succeed in this practice unless you have other people around. And if they're demanding people, it's even easier. Okay? All right, so those are ideal circumstances for this practice, you know? So at a primitive level, it's what we talked about in the church on Thursday night. It means to put yourself in their place in the sense of, what does this person want right now? You know, and as we said in the church, you follow their eyes a lot, you know. Follow their eyes and see what they like. You know, and it's true that the eyes are the mirror of the soul. And the meaning of that is, if you watch a person's eyes as they move around the room, you know, they will start to focus on the things they like and the things they want. So, you know, if it's a person who really likes chocolate cake and you have a chocolate cake on the table, it's sort of kind of cruel, but sit there across from them and their eyes will keep going. You know, like, you know what I mean? Or, you know, there's tea over here and juice over there and they like tea. You know, they'll just be glancing occasionally over at the tea. And it's unconscious. You're not really conscious that you're doing it. But a bodhisattva has to watch these things. You see what I mean? Because a bodhisattva wants to make sure that they get what they want. And we gave the example of this little quiet, jolly, round baby monk in New Jersey named Jampa Lungrik, who's like just quietly a great bodhisattva. You know, all he does is make tea and clean the house and brush the dog. And, you know, and it looks like that's all he does. But if you go there, the tea tastes better than anywhere else. You know, he has this strange knack for providing you exactly what you wanted. And within the first few days of meeting you, he knows what your favorite food is. He knows what you want to do during the day. He knows what kind of thing you like to drink. He knows when you get thirsty. He knows everything. He's been watching you. And he never says anything. I've never seen him get angry. I've never seen him complain. Once. And we're talking hundreds of crazy American students junking up the house, you know, leaving messes in the bathroom. He just quietly goes in and cleans them up and never says anything. Never. I've never. You know, he's prone to these horrible headaches. I never heard him mention it to anybody. You know, he just does it, you know. And that's such a, that's the way. So we call in the computer business transparent. A program should be transparent, meaning it's easy to use and you don't know why, because the guy who designed it was thinking ahead. So transparent Dakshin Nyamje means you're just watching other people and you don't even tell them. They never know that you're plotting their benefit. You see what I mean? And it's kind of a reverse schizophrenia or whatever you call it. Paranoia. It's a reverse paranoia. You know, where you're plotting to make them happy and not let them know. You see what I mean? Like, at an extreme level, you'd break into people's houses and put money in their wallets and stuff like that. on the assumption that everyone likes money. But you just, the first levels of this practice, the primitive what I'd say the very beginning levels, are to observe what people physically want, what they're attracted to. You figure out what kind of thing they want to talk about, and then you talk about that. You figure out what kind of cereal they like the most, and you buy that, and you have that in the house, and you figure out what they like to drink, and that's what they is, and it's on there, it's on the table in front of them before they can ask you. And you get better at anticipating their wishes than they are. And you know 3 minutes ahead what they're going to want, and you're already setting it up for them. And this is if you want to know the holiest thing to do with your life, if you're going to die tonight, this is it, okay? For many reasons, and we'll go into the reasons, but karmically, it's just the most intelligent thing you can do. And then universally, it's the rightest thing you can do. You know what I mean? It's the goodest thing you can do in the world, you know, is to think about other people's wishes and try to satisfy them, okay? So we're talking on a very basic physical level. Then you get up to a mental level. You know, what would make this person happy right now? You know, would they like me to talk about this, or would they like me to talk about that? Are they having some problem at work that I could talk to them about? Or do they have a family problem that they might want me to talk about with them? Are they happy to talk about their own work? And they'd most enjoy at this moment to hear me talk about that with them. Or, you know, so you go from the level of physical comfort, meaning food and drink, and you take care of them that way, and then you move up to their emotional needs, you know, and you think, what would this person like me to be talking about right now, and what would they like to talk about right now, and what would make them happy right now? And you take care of that. Transparently, they never know. Okay, I saw this thing in Dear Abby, okay, 20 years ago or something, and she said, do something good for somebody every day secretly. Just don't tell them. They never know. You know, their bank account goes up $100, they think it was a mistake in their checkbook or something. And they never know that you snuck it in there or something like that. You see, I mean, take care of other people secretly. That's at the end of the 8 verses also. You know, may I help other people openly and then secretly. You know what I mean? So take care of their emotional needs. Then move up to their spiritual needs. You see what I mean? And figure out ways to give them what they need spiritually. You see what I mean? And just when they need it, just what they needed, at the moment that they needed it, you're supplying it to them, transparently if possible. You know, maybe it's just in a conversation, or you're just mentioning something, and you know it's going to be of spiritual benefit to them. Yeah?
Mental needs and spiritual needs the same in this case?
I'd say physical, emotional, then spiritual. You see what I mean? What would make them happy in their tummy? And it's not only tummy, but, you know, what's the temperature in the room? You know, I happen to know that Dr. Taylor likes a cold room. You know, I happen to know this other person likes a warm room. So you think about what they would like, and you heat the room up before they get there. They never know that you've prepared it for them. You see what I mean? And you're just watching out for them. And this is first level, physical needs, and then emotional needs. You know, you're talking about what they'd like to talk about. You're calling them when they'd like to get called, and things like that. Transparently, they're not aware that you're sitting at home, like, you know, sweating over what they would like, you know what I mean? And then move up to spiritual needs. When it's proper, when it's appropriate, you know, pop something spiritual on them, so, you know, and something they need. There's this vow, I forget where it is, We're not supposed to, when we choose a teaching for a group, we're not supposed to teach what we'd like to teach. We're supposed to teach what might be most beneficial for them at that moment. And there's a vow about that, you know. It's like, oh, I've been through this 3 times. I'd rather teach them something else because I haven't been through it 3 times. And then you got to think, no, that's not right. What do they need? What's good for them at that moment? And you have to design it that way. So those are the three sort of a beginning way to do it, okay? And you watch. See, in this case, you're still preserving the distinction between you and them. And that's what makes it primitive. You see, you're still thinking, I'm me, them's them, I want what I want, they want what they want, but we'll give them what they want first. You know what I mean? And you're still dividing between you and me. You know, you're still, at the beginning of this practice, you are still thinking, they're them, I'm me, and I'm giving up what I want so that they can have what they want. And that's a primitive form of this practice. Okay, that's level number one, okay? Now we go to a deeper form of the practice, okay? Where you're actually switching over to their eyes and looking at things in their body. And that's a deeper level, okay? Instead of sitting in your body and trying to imagine what they want, you actually meditate on being inside of them, inside of their head and inside of their body. You're watching Michael Roach talk. You see what I mean? You're sitting out there hoping he'll finish on time because your knees hurt and, you know, trying to look interested, you know, and you know what I mean? And you actually, rather than me trying to think what you might want, you see, and me sitting here and you sitting there, now I'm sitting there and I'm watching me. And that's level two of the Dakshin Nyamje. Okay? So you're actually physically imagining that you're in their body and you're watching you. And you're trying to think how they think. You see? That's different than trying to guess how they think. Now you're in their mind and you're thinking like they think. And it's actual, like some kind of teleporting your, you know, beam them down, Scotty, and put, you know, and put your body in their body and watch you. And then think of being them. And that's like a second level Dakshin Nyamje. Okay? It's getting more sophisticated and more serious. Okay? Then the ultimate level is reflected in the readings that you're going to get. Okay? And this requires some study. So reading number 5 in particular, no, 4 and 5, okay, most of 4 and 5 is how to do the highest form of Dakshin Nyamje. And this is where you seek to remove the distinction between you and me. You see what I mean? So I a little bit object to calling this teaching exchanging myself and you. You see what I mean? It's really becoming one person. You know, it's really expanding my sense of me to include you. And you become me. You become a part of Michael Roach. You see what I mean? So at the highest form of this practice, you are actually, when you give them what they like to eat, you are giving you what you like to eat. See what I mean? And you're expanding your sense of yourself to include other people. And now, in Master Shantideva, in this chapter that we took it from, it's from the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. And he very masterfully treats all the objections to thinking like this. You see? And I'll talk about some of the objections. And they're in your homework, okay? So, by the way, this section on how to exchange yourself and others starts out in a very interesting way. He says, take thyself to a quiet forest. Sleep under the trees. Divest. You know? Don't have too many things. Don't have too many activities. I mean, peripheral gray area goof-off activities. Don't junk up your life to the point where you can just barely have enough time to do your meditation. Divest until you got plenty of buffer to do your meditation. If you want to meditate an extra 20 minutes, there's nobody going to be let down because you're not there. Divest to the point where you have true leisure. You know, so he calls it go out to the forest, but what it means in the commentary says is mentally divest until you have enough space in your life to practice the most important practices. Yeah.
Sometimes there are relationships that don't seem to be doing me a lot of good, but I just have a sense that I want to be helpful to the person.
We're not talking about those. Those are not junk. Those are precious. You see? Big difference. And we're talking about the ones you engage in just that have an idle talk for an afternoon or something like that, okay? For you. You see what I mean? The ones that you're maintaining because it helps someone else, that's bodhisattva activity, right? So here you're actually... The first thing it's interesting how he gets to it, you see? He says, he doesn't say, oh, exchange yourself and others. He says, go out in the forest. Meaning, simplify your life down till you're almost living in a hut, mentally, you see? And then practice the sweetest practice of all. And then he gets into Dakshin Nyamje. You know, and for me it was like almost contradictory because he's saying, go simplify your life, go live in the forest. And by the way, exchange yourself with all the people around you. You know what I mean? And then the commentaries say it means work your normal job, have your normal family, but mentally be in a forest and have lots of space. Meaning, you simplified your life to what's important. You're not doing unimportant things, and you have lots of free mental space. And then do the practice of exchanging yourself and others. This is what you want to do with your life if you're going to die tonight. So I'm trying to say, that's what he's trying to say. He's trying to say that if you knew you were going to die tonight, the most important thing you could do is not something physical. It's something mental, you see. It's something inside of you. And that's the feeling on the plane as we were, thought we were all going to die. And you had an automatic Dakshin Nyamje. Everybody started to bond with everybody else. You see? That was the result of a death meditation. It wasn't so much giving up my car. It wasn't so much, you know, those were already gone. Already people weren't thinking about the movie, the pretzels, or where they were sitting and how fat the guy next to them was. They had already stopped thinking about that. But what was the next thing they did? They started to bond. I've never felt anything like that since then, never, ever. This outpouring of love and sympathy for the people around them. And that's what would really happen if we were all going to die tonight. You know, I mean, what would really happen, and the point of death meditation is to trigger this emotion towards other people. What's his name? Who wrote Candide? Voltaire. Yeah, Voltaire said... He said something very serious called see other people as your fellow sufferers in life. You know, and have this empathy for other people and this sweet sorrow for people who are all dying together. You see, and that the ultimate goal of death meditation is that. It's not so much giving up certain activities, giving up certain possessions, changing your relationships is just the beginning. See, what happens later is you just start to bond with everybody. You see what I mean? Because everybody you meet is on a plane is going down. And why hassle each other? Why fight with each other? What's the point of being right or wrong if we're all dying in 15 minutes? You see what I mean? And if your mind can get to that state, you're successful at death meditation. And that's Dakshin Nyamje. You see what I mean? Then you're exchanging yourself and others. Because the boundary between you and others has just expanded to include them. You see what I mean? The boundary of who I is has just slipped from my skin and your skin to fit behind your skin. You see what I mean? You've redefined the self. The real point of exchanging self and others is not... The primitive one is to watch them and do what they want. The next point is to put your head in their body and watch you and doing what they want. But the highest form is to eliminate the boundary between you and others. And as long as you call it exchange, I think it's a little... The word is bad. It should be called, you know, redefining myself to include Petra or something like that. You see what I mean? Oh, God, now I got two mouths to feed. You see what I mean? No, really, I got four feet to put shoes on now. You see? I got four pairs of eyes I got to take care of, you know? I got to wear monk's clothes and I got to find ladies' clothes also. You see what I mean? And, you see what I mean? And that can only come if you practice. Now see how death meditation goes into that? The divestment has already happened. And then naturally you feel this sweet sadness. Look, we're all going to die. Why do we fight with each other? Why do we argue with each other? How many people on a plane that's going to crash in 15 minutes are arguing with each other about which seat is more comfortable? It's all pales in comparison to the fact that we're all dying together. You see what I mean? So the feeling that we're all dying together should make this kind of family feeling or this kind of redefinition of yourself to expand to everyone here. Because what's the use of struggling against each other if we're all dying? You see? What are you trying to protect? You know, somebody said something bad to you. Who gives a damn if you're all going to be dead in 10 years, you see what I mean? Or tonight? What's the point? You see what I mean? It's like frustrating, you know, like, what's the point of being unkind to each other if we're all dying together, you know? So you got to get to that. That's the real goal of a death meditation. You see, if you're doing it well, it's not that you got the right color lights going in your head or something, or that you're like scared of dying or something like that. It's not like that. The real end of a death meditation should be this feeling of, why are we hurting each other if we're all going to die together? You know, if we're all dying. And the people that I meet now, when I come back the next time here, some of you might be dead. So what's the point? You know, why would I fight with you about the tea or the coffee or who gets a cookie or, you know? You know, the whole idea is to eliminate the boundary between yourself and others through a death meditation. And that's the holiest practice you can do. And that's real bodhicitta, okay? Then you have all these natural objections in your mind, and Shantideva very nicely goes through them. Master Shantideva sweetly goes through them. So we're going to talk about some of them. The main thing is this. Your conception of who you are is, first of all, largely visually oriented, like so many things in life. Do you know why the first skanda is called form, and the object of the eye is called form? Why are they the same? Because the skanda includes all other senses also. So why do they give the name, the object of the eye, to the skanda or the heap of the physical body? Why? Because you define yourself visually. 90% of how you define yourself is visual. My skin stops here. Bill's skin starts there. Therefore, we're different. You know. Therefore, he's not me. Therefore, he's him and I'm me. And therefore, every language in the world has different pronouns. I and you. You know what I mean? Mostly visual. You know what I mean? I stop at my skin, and he starts at his skin. Because that's what I see. You see what I mean? And Master Shantideva says, stop thinking like that. Okay? Stop letting that be the boundary of who you are. Because that's just arbitrary. Okay? That's just arbitrary. And then the immediate objection comes up in your mind. I assume it's already happened. But when you poke that skin with a pin, it don't hurt you. You know what I mean? And when I poke this skin with a pin, it does hurt me. And I know it's very noble to think of Bill and me as being the same person, but, you know, I'd rather have him get poked with a pin than me. You know, you know what I mean? And Master Shantideva says, no, that's not correct. You know, you have the power to define where pain becomes relevant. You see what I mean? You have the power, a human being has the power to say, my boundary of unacceptable pain will extend to the back of Bill's back. You see, you have the power to do that because it's all arbitrary anyway. The minute you own an object, or the minute you have a family and someone hits your kid, do you feel pain? Brandy's child. Somebody comes up and punches that kid, will she feel anything? I mean, will she get upset? Yeah, I mean, she has chosen, for good or bad reasons, doesn't matter, to extend her sense of herself beyond herself to embrace the child. You see what I mean? So you do it all the time. Family people here are doing it all the time. Don't tell me you can't do it. Master Shantideva says, don't tell me you can't do that. You can easily extend. You do it all the time. A person comes down 6th Street in New York. I've got my car out there and there's 30 other cars on the street. But if they start hitting my windshield with a brick, do I react or not? You know, in a sense, do I feel pain? Do I feel invaded when they do that? Yes, because my sense of Michael Roach has extended beyond the car, to include the car, because it's my car. You see what I mean? So don't tell me you can't do it when you want to do it. You just don't want to do it, okay? You think somehow it's better not to do it. And that's it. What he calls fatal error. He, at the end of the reading, he says, fatal error, you know? Yeah?
What I hear you saying, defining boundaries, where that person begins and or ends and I begin and end.
Yeah.
What's to differentiate myself from where Buddha Shakyamuni begins and ends? I define that from if I'm understanding what you're saying.
Yeah.
Or any of the other Buddhas.
Yeah, no, maybe in tantric practice you might try that. Okay. But that's a little further beyond us right now. Okay, that's a little further than we're going today. The practice today is a path to that. You see what I mean? You can do that. In tantric practice, kirim is partly that, okay? That we can't teach in public, okay? But of course it's a part of that. So the idea today is that to realize that where you draw the line of me is arbitrary. So draw it in an intelligent way. What's intelligent? Encompass everyone in the room. You know what I mean? And there's no difference between me not getting my dinner and Petra not getting my dinner. Okay? Ultimately, if you want to be radically successful in your practice and become a tantric data in this life, this is the way. This is the real way. You know? Very radical and very holy. And all great saints have done it in all religions. You know? That I don't draw a distinction between me getting dinner and she. I'm not giving up my dinner so that Petra can have it. I'm feeding myself. Okay? And you have to... And it draws on the fact that the distinction of who I am and who I'm not is arbitrary. It's something based on my past karma. It's something based on my past way of thinking. It's arbitrary. You can also choose to stop yourself here, and people do. You know what I mean? Like in a war or something, or when an animal... pulls itself out of a trap and the leg is left behind for the good of the rest of the body. That's arbitrary. They've chosen that this part is not going to be them because they want the rest to survive. You see? People do that. they disassociate from, when you agree to have something cut off of you or something like that, a cancer cut out of your body, you're stating in effect that you don't want that to be part of me anymore. You see what I mean? So I can extend beyond the skin and I can extend within the skin. It's a matter of choice, really. It's a matter of training. Master Shantideva says everything is a matter of training. You can train yourself to think any way you want. It's just a matter of practicing. He's very big on practice, you know. If you practice long enough to think of your body as extending to the skin on Bill's back, then you can in time, by thinking about it constantly, redefine who me is. And it's very, very satisfying, okay? Like, what happens is that all the people around you become your family. You see what I mean? It's very, very satisfying. And then there's no struggle. Why is it that a bodhisattva can reach into their eye socket and rip out their own eye and hand it to someone? Why is it they can do that? Because they're not thinking of the other person as another person. You know, I need my eye, so I gotta rip it out right now. Because I need, you know, this is the trick to doing all these impossible things that Lama Sapa does. Not like that, you know. It's, they're cheating. Okay? They're not really thinking of other people as other people, you know. They're just serving themselves, you know what I mean? Would you like, I would like to get this initiation till 3 a.m. this morning. You see what I mean? And then he can stay up till 3 a.m. this morning because it's important to him, because he's sitting watching him. You know, because the part of him that's sitting watching him doesn't have it yet. You know what I mean? And he thinks that. That's, you got to get to that point, okay? But you have to do it in stages. You have to go through those other two, okay? Let's see some more objections he has. By the way, the objection about the pain is very famous and very common. I've heard it for 20... It was asked of my lama in 1974. I remember sitting there and hearing someone say... I don't extend to Bill because when Bill gets poked with the pin, I don't hurt. And that's just a decision not to feel hurt when he gets hurt. You see what I mean? Because when your own mother gets punched by somebody, it hurts. And you do something about it. You've chosen to extend yourself to your mother or to your house. You know, it's bad if somebody burns your house or breaks your house. It's not so bad if they break your neighbor's house, because the me doesn't extend to their house, but it extends to your house. You see what I mean? And that's arbitrary. And the decision to limit it to some bad habit of the past, to the skin or your house, is hurting you. Okay? Now the next argument they give. And these are some... You'll have 6 arguments in your reading. Okay? One is that you got to get used to thinking of suffering as a common enemy. Suffering is something we should hate no matter who has it. You see what I mean? So you have to learn to think of suffering as something to be removed no matter who has it. The enemy of mankind is suffering. So no matter who has it, we have to try to get rid of it. And I have a good example here. Like, I used to have... I have a lot of students. Students come to me. In my early years, I would have students come to me and say, you know that person, that other group that you don't like? I don't like them either. Let's stick together. I'll help you. You know, I'll work on your board and we'll do our best. Not like that other group, you know. And, you know, I support you and not them. You know, and in my stupid early years, I'm like, thank you. You know, that's, you know, you could be treasurer of our group. You know, and then in my wiser years, what happens is, what you're doing is saying, I like your mental affliction because it's helping me right now. You see what I mean? I like your mental affliction because I'm the beneficiary right now, and it's very short-sighted. Why? Sooner or later, mental afflictions come around. You know, sooner or later, it's directed at you. What I'm saying is, don't put up with suffering in anybody in this room. Consider suffering unacceptable. Period. As a principle, suffering is unacceptable. And don't be so concerned about which body it happens to be in right now. You see, suffering on the whole is unacceptable and must be fought against. Then you've got to fight against the cause of suffering, which is what? Mental afflictions. Okay? So whether it's in your friend's head or your enemy's head, you must vow to eradicate it from the face of the earth. And that has to be your attitude. I will not put up with jealousy, whether it's in my mind or one of my students' mind. You see? And I won't draw a distinction between the two very much. You see? Whether it's in one of my students' minds or whether it's in my mind, it's equally harmful. And if you don't think so, then let one of your close friends or relatives continue to be angry at someone else, and sooner or later you'll find it be directed at you. You see, I mean, mental afflictions suck no matter whose mind they're in. And we have to say, we have to remove the distinction between you and me in that sense too. We have to work to eradicate, through equal effort, the mental afflictions of every person in this room. Okay? Period. We can't put up with mental afflictions. And we drop the boundary between you and me. Your jealousy and my jealousy are both unacceptable. I can't stand to see you suffer from that. And I can't stand to see me suffer from that. And it's just, as a principle, we choose that this is the enemy. And we will eradicate it from this room. Okay? And that's another form of exchanging self and others. I think that when you hear exchanging self and others, you often don't get the full story. This is a form of exchanging self and others. Because you are breaking down the boundary between you and me. You know, jealousy as a whole is unacceptable in our Dharma group. And each of us should watch each of us to help us not to have jealousy. And it doesn't matter whether it's in your mind. It is in my mind. And if I see it, if I think it's in your mind, never be sure, right? I don't know if you're a deity or what. But if it seems to be in your mind, I have to help you eradicate it too. Because any illness that's spreading in your mind will sooner or later spread to mine. Okay? That's very important. That's another way of breaking down the distinction between yourself and others. Okay? That's another practice. Okay? Then there's this famous one that His Holiness uses so often. It's called the democratic principle. Okay? Like, there's X number of people in this room that want to be happy. There's X number of people in this room who equally don't want to be unhappy. And we must work for that equally. You see what I mean? We must achieve the happiness of the beings in this room, period. And everybody wants it. Now, democratically speaking, you know, you use democracy when it's advantageous to you and you break it, you don't use it when it's not. You know what I mean? As long as democracy is what brings you out ahead, you tend to support it. And then when it means that you're going to get outvoted in a board, you're like, maybe I don't like this board anymore. You know? But democratically, if you're going to be democratic about it, other people outnumber you. This is His Holiness's beautiful argument. And it's a little hard to swallow for someone who's interested in their own happiness only. But if you think about it, I should do what you guys want and not what I want if I'm democratic. Because you outvote me. Okay? You outnumber me. Other people outnumber you. Use one and they's 99. So they get what they want. If you're going to be really democratic, if you're going to be noble, then majority rule. And your what you want should come last. Because they outnumber you. Okay? That's called the democracy principle of breaking down self and others. Okay? They should get what they want just by virtue of what's just. Justice means that the most people who want something should get it in a group. You know, if you're going to be fair, I mean, not at the expense of the minority, right? But if it's a choice that, you know, what would be the best thing to do, you have to go with the majority. And you guys outnumber me, so I have to do what you want. You see what I mean? Yeah.
In some of your other talks or teachings, you indicated that society over a period of time takes wrong views.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that if you're talking about from the perspective of the majority or
yeah. He said oftentimes the majority of a society, especially in the desire realm, you have to understand we are in the desire realm. That's not just some Buddhist thing they made up, blah, blah, blah. There are other realms, okay? In the desire realm, things don't work right. Okay? We are in a defective realm. It should have been recalled. Okay? Okay? I'm not kidding. This realm is defective. This realm doesn't work right, okay? If you get to be in this realm, it's because you had mental afflictions in your past life, okay? You're here because the whole idea of original sin is not so crazy. You know, this realm doesn't work right. And anybody who gets to be in this realm is a little crazy by definition. You see what I mean? Because to get here, you got to have some major mental afflictions. You can't get to this realm unless you have some mental afflictions. Okay? This is the monastery principle. People come to me and say, I don't know, ever since I went to Sarah, I was really disappointed. And I say, why? And they say, a lot of the monks are just as bad as normal people, you know? And you say, that's why we're in the monastery. <You know? laughs> That's why we came here, to get fixed, you know? But anyway, it really, truly is a defective realm, which means that a lot of what's considered proper or right in this realm is crazy. You know, just a lot of the attitudes in this realm are like the distinction between you and me, which is like one of the most basic things about our world. The difference between you and me, the words you and me in every language are different, which means that in every culture on this earth, they draw a distinction between you and me based on visual, you know, based on skin, or based on the fact that when I poke that skin with a pin, something happens in him and doesn't happen in me. And ignorant of the fact that, of course, you can expand me to cover Bill, or you can expand me to not cover your arm if your arm has to be cut off. You know what I mean? You can shrink it or expand it as you choose. But we're in a realm where that's considered stupid, to expand it to everybody. I wouldn't have enough money for myself. Yeah, you wouldn't. So we have to make more for us. You see what I mean? To feed us. You see what I mean? It'd be a weird place, right? So anyway, what you're saying is that, yeah, it is true that in majority things in the world, in the desire realm, what the majority wants is often very wrong. So I remember being in Geshe Darge's class in Dharamsala, and somebody said, why should I be concerned and watch this person to see what they want to eat and what they want to drink when most of their desires are wrong? You know, most of their desires are hurting them. They want more food than their body can absorb. They want things to drink that are going to hurt them. Why should I work on temporary happinesses and not concentrate on ultimate ones? And Geshe Darge got like mad. It was weird, you know. And he said, no, you must give them what they want. You see what I mean? I mean, I'm not talking alcohol or guns or things like that. But I mean, an extra piece of chocolate cake? Yeah, give it to them. You must think that you serve them what they want at the lower levels. You know what I mean? Like, they want an extra piece of cake, you give them an extra piece of cake, because it's a holy thing to serve others, even for the moment. You see, he was very adamant that even to serve them with momentary needs that are not real needs, but if it would make them a little bit happier, and I'm not saying a heart attack risk patient or blah blah blah, I'm saying, you know, a normal person who wants some cake, that it's a holy bodhisattva practice to serve them something that'll make them happy for another 3 minutes or so. You know, that never think that's unimportant. He was very adamant about it. So that's all. As far as majority rule, I mean things like that. You know, should you go along with the New York Times worldview that says the way to stop a conflict in Kosovo is to kill someone? No, you shouldn't go along with that. You shouldn't go along with that. The reason you are forced to see people killing other people in your world is your wrong views and your wrong activities. And if your mind was pure, it wouldn't be going on. You see, ultimately Buddhism says that peace in the world is achieved in your world by being pure. And you'll be forced to sit in a big group of 10th level bodhisattvas, and they don't have tanks or airplanes or anything. You see, you've created the Kosovo, and ultimately this is the thing. People ask me, which side of the Shukden controversy are you on? And I say, I'm on the side that says I shouldn't have disrespected my lamas in the past and have to see this terrible thing. That's which side I'm on. So to remove that, am I going to be on side A or side B? No, I'm going to be on side C, which says I have to treat my lamas better in the future so I don't have to see someone picketing the Dalai Lama. You know what I mean? That's come about because of my bad deeds, you know, because I was not respectful to my lamas. And that's why in my world, someone's picketing the holiest being on the world, you know? And if you don't like it, then be better to your lamas. You see? That's worldview. That's Buddhist worldview. You see what I mean? Very cool. Yeah?
I'm still not getting, though, the 3 minutes of temporary happiness.
Just that it's a holy thing to serve someone else and make them happy, even if it's only for 3 minutes. At the expense of giving them higher happiness, no. But as an immediate thing, I think all bodhisattvas are interested in that. You see?
The only thing I can think of is that maybe it'll give you a chance to keep talking to him.
Well, that's enough. No, I think the main thing is the habit of wanting them to be happy. At any level, temporary, cake, more long-term, place to stay,
so
more long...
you make them happy for 3 minutes to have a cigarette or a drink, you give it to them.
No, I said except for alcohol or weapons. We're not allowed... The Dana Paramita, as Master Shantideva is careful to point out, doesn't extend to things which will obviously harm them. And you're not allowed to give a weapon to a person who's going to commit suicide with it, or alcohol to a person who's going to be crazy with it, or something like that. Now, will chocolate cake hurt them in the long run? Probably a little bit. My lama used to overfeed his dog, you know, and and he would stuff her. She was like, she was dragging on the ground, you know. And I said, Rinpoche, you know, you're really hurting her. And she says, but it makes her so happy. And anyway, that's the principle. All right.
If you extend yourself to all other beings, and wouldn't that mean that you have an infinite number of mental afflictions?
She said, if you extend yourself to all other beings, wouldn't you have an infinite number of mental afflictions? It's more to extend yourself in the sense of fulfilling their needs as if they were you. That's all. That's all. So actually, you'd be faced with the task of eliminating infinite mental afflictions. And that's what bodhisattvas do. That's our dream, you know. That's our dream of a career path, you know, to want to do that, you see. Yeah. Okay, let's see what else it says. So it's the idea that nobody you meet is any different from you, okay? I mean, another reason that the distinction between you and others is so false is that ultimately you are thinking exactly the same. Nobody wants to suffer. Everybody wants to be happy. Everybody has the same state of mind. There are slight differences in attitudes. There are slight differences in philosophies. There are slight differences in perceptions. But ultimately, we are totally the same. And this is not some kind of false logic or something like that. It's not sophistry. It's not some kind of naive thinking. It's absolutely true. It's not His Holiness being, you know, Jesus-y or something. It's not that. It's not like that. It's a very profound truth that we're all the same. You know, we are really all the same. Everybody wants to be happy. No one wants to suffer. So this distinction that we draw artificially between each other is false. It's just flatly false. Okay, we're all the same. That's all. Okay, and that's so profound that it sounds naive, and as very profound things often do, and you have to think about it that way. So how many arguments we got now that against the distinction of yourself and others? I mean, the first one was what?
Used to thinking of suffering as a common enemy. Used to thinking of suffering as a common enemy.
I think one is. Think of all suffering in the room, and I would include all causes of suffering in the room. Like, I'm more, when I get to this particular meditation, I'm more remembering in the past when I used to support mental afflictions in others if they were serving me. You see what I mean? If your mental affliction means that you side with me rather than with them, we'll live with that mental affliction. That's a stupid idea, okay? Mental afflictions must be stamped out whichever skull they happen to be in. Suffering, which is the result of mental afflictions, must be stamped out whichever bag of skin they're in. Okay? So that's two. What's another one? That's one, really.
Okay. See, I have think of all causes of suffering, then fight against suffering, and democratic principle, and then everybody you meet is the same as you. No one's different.
Well, one is the idea that I think one of the sub-meditations here has to be that the demarcation between me and Bill is artificial. Okay? It's artificial. It's just a decision. You know, it actually happens to be a projection of my past karma. I'm so used to thinking of me and Bill as separate because when you poke him with a pin, I don't feel that precise pain, that I believe it now. And I live by it. And that is the cause of all suffering. You see what I mean? Drawing that distinction and then believing that it's natural is causes all your suffering. Okay? Yeah?
How do you relate this to the fact that we all have separate mind streams?
By the way, I'm not suggesting that we all have the same mind stream. I never said that. I was careful not to say that because I knew somebody would bring that up. Okay. Do you mold into one big mind stream later? No. Do all Buddhas become one big fat Buddha? No. Is there a supreme consciousness? You know, no. Why? Because karma is collected individually.
Well, how can we be one with everybody else's?
The idea is to conceptualize that physical, visual thing as being part of me. That's all. That's all. You can decide that another mind stream's happiness and suffering is as much your concern as yours is. You see what I mean? That's okay. I'm not suggesting that the mind streams are the same. If that mind stream out there does good deeds, that mind stream's going to get itself enlightened. If this mind stream, you know what I mean? There is a distinction like that. I'm not saying that. But you will not get enlightened unless you learn to do this practice. How's that? You know, I gave you the carrot, now I give you the stick. it's not only the right thing to do. It is the holiest purpose of a person who's going to die tonight. This is the smartest thing you can do with your life if you're going to die tonight. And you can go to work for the last day and do it there. See what I mean? Now death meditation gets a little more difficult. It'd be easy if it was just quitting your job. But we're saying you may want to spend your last day of your life at work breaking down the distinction between you and me. Because that's the holiest thing you can do if that's all the time you got left in your life. And your death meditation must go there at some point. Skydive? Get that over with. Go to all those movies you haven't seen yet? Get that over with. You know what I mean? Tell that person what you really think. Get that over with. You know, apologize to that person you really wanted to apologize to. But we're embarrassed, you know. And get that over with, because you won't be around tomorrow to be embarrassed, you know. And then go do Dakshin Nyamje, you know. And the point I want to make is, you may end up doing this at the same job you did the last 10 years. And you may want to spend the last day of your life at that job, practicing Dakshin Nyamje. Okay, that's all. So we're talking something much more difficult than what we called, divesting. We're talking divesting of an attitude. That's much harder, okay, and much holier. You know, can you, in the last day of your life, do the holiest thing possible, which is to extend the self to include other people until they become you? You know, because it's arbitrary anyway. And all great holy beings have done that. You have to go through that. You have to reach that ability, okay? Sooner or later, you're going to have to do it. And you can see it in a small Dharma group, for example, if it gets sweet, if people are keeping their vows, then even something like food becomes confusing. you know, whose pancakes are those? I don't know, we've all been eating it, you know? And I mean, it's a sign that even eating becomes, it's beautiful, it's a beautiful thing. A cup of tea becomes everyone's cup of tea, and we forget whose it was, you see, because it's everybody's. And money becomes the... You know, we run everybody's credit cards out. And I'm not kidding. And there's not much concern about whether it's mine or yours. You see what I mean? And there's one fork and there's a plate of food and everybody's eating from it. Because you're starting to break down that idea that even this is my food, you see. This is whoever's food is hungry and needs to eat it right now. And what's amazing is the bread and the fish thing really happens. That the karma of that sweet attitude is that you'll have enough for everybody. It's a very amazing. That's the miracle of the bread and the fish. The karma of wanting everyone to be fed is that somehow the bread is multiplying. And it's weird. It's very profound. The cause for there being enough wealth in the world for everyone is the willingness of everyone to share all the wealth they have. And then there would be enough for everyone. And they'd come back with more fish and bread than they started with and say, how'd that happen? You see what I mean? And it can happen like that. So don't get scared when your credit cards get run out. serving others, you know. There'll be some big benefactor just over the... at the end of the month, no doubt. Okay. All right, so we're going to meditate on that. You ready? Why don't you take like a 5-minute break, stretch, and then we'll do the last room. Okay. All right.
Session 6 continues on the next CD.